Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Welcome, Gladys and Potties, to another LNL, our final one from this year's Adelaide Festival of Ideas. And can you imagine a guest who can be pro-Thatcher, pro-monarchy, pro-nuclear power, pro-GM food, and who still gets himself a standing ovation? It could only be James Lovelock. And he was immensely popular at the festival, despite his recalcitrant views. Here we are on a brisk Sunday morning in the City of Churches in the appropriately ecclesiastic Bonython Hall to hear a prophet for the 21st century. James Ephraim Lovelock was born in 1919, the son of Tom and Nellie. What I'd like to do, at least for a few minutes, is to go through your early life a bit, James, to see where you came from. I understand that your father used to take you for long walks and teach you to observe clearly.
That's right. He was a countryman. He was born in 1872, which is a heck of a long time ago, in Berkshire, the county in southern England. And they had a terribly rough life because his father died when they were young. And there were no welfare systems in those days. And his mother had 13 children to bring up. He was the oldest of them, so he had to take on kind of responsibility. And that meant finding food to keep them all going. And he was a bit too good at it because he got caught by a local gamekeeper poaching and spent 6 months in Reading jail doing hard labour when he was small. He also had no education at all, so that he couldn't read or write. And in spite of that, he ran away to London after getting out of prison and got a job in the high-tech industry of those days, which was the gasworks. And it so happened that the chap who owned it, a chemist called Dr. Roger Livesey, saw that my dad was a bit above average, and sent him immediately to Battersea Polytechnic to learn reading and writing. And so he was all right, but he had this wonderful countryman's knowledge of ecology. He knew the tracks of all the animals, the names of all the wildflowers, and it was a complete joy to go for walks with him in the country. And I think my feeling about the natural world grew up from that.
I understand that you and your wife have similar walks to this day.
We do indeed. We walk most days when we're home. We walk 5 miles and climb about 400 or 500 feet doing it, and do it at about 3.5 miles an hour.
James, you and I both remember childhoods where horsepower meant horses.
Indeed. Worse than that, there was an occasion when I ran a milk round from a local farm. And the first time I did it, I asked the farmer, how will I know where to go? And he said, oh, you don't have to worry, the horse knows. And sure enough, it did. It stopped at every house, and I just ladled the amount of milk out to the churn for the customers. And when the round was finished, the horse just went off back. So, in a sense, one of my first jobs was to be an assistant to a horse.
We're also talking about a time, of course, which was pre-electric.
Mm-hmm. It was indeed. Not only pre-electric, there was no radio. Television hadn't even been thought of. And most houses were lit either with oil lamps or, if you were fairly rich, with gas. And that was it. But you never felt deprived as a result of that.
Everything changes and nothing changes. We live at a time of crashing conflict between religious fundamentalisms, but you recall a childhood where superstition was incredibly powerful.
Oh, it was. It was amazing, especially in the countryside. People really believed in ghosts, and they wouldn't go out to certain places at night and things like that. And everybody, when they walked around, when, for example, if they spilt some salt at lunch, they would always throw it over their shoulder. Heaven knows why. You mustn't cross your knives. There are an amazing number of superstitions guided life. Touching wood was as natural as anything. And I remember when I first became a scientist, it required a terrific act of will to sort of say, but this is ridiculous. You've got to stop doing this and no more touching wood or anything.
We're talking in a building haunted by the ghost of Kim Benython, so... it's odd to me that we're describing an extraordinary lifetime, aren't we, from a world of medieval superstition, pre-electric horsepower, and we're now on the edge of disaster in the 21st century. One of the areas which makes you intensely unpopular with many of the people who were your greatest fans is, of course, the nuclear area. Mm-hmm. But you regard the attitude to nuclear power as, in a sense, 21st century superstition.
Exactly. It's the same myths and legends which have hardly a breath of truth in them. People believe things about nuclear waste and whatnot, which are so untrue, it's almost unbelievable. To give you an idea of the extent of exaggeration, we were given a pamphlet outside one of the halls we talked at, the town hall, the other night, and it showed a map of Australia on the front page and a huge cooling tower, which was about 500 miles in diameter, stuck in the middle of it, and so high it stuck right up out into space, and some noxious something coming out of the top of it. Well, of course, no cooling tower is that big, but it's a measure of the exaggeration. And of course, cooling towers, as any engineer would tell you, are things you have at all power stations to improve the efficiency of the turbines. They're nothing to do with the radioactivity of the whatever nuclear plant there is that's producing the steam.
Sir McFarlane Burnett, who was an Australian Nobel laureate, used to warn me and others against nuclear power on the basis, his first argument against it, and this is going back to the late 60s or early 70s, was terrorist attack. Mm-hmm. He envisaged, quite presciently, the possibility of airliners being hijacked and flown into nuclear power stations. What would happen if that happened? There was an attempt, as you know, in the US in the 70s.
Well, this has been calculated quite often. The thickness of the concrete shield around most nuclear power stations, except some of the ones in Russia, which are not really is not quite the same as the Western world, they are so thick that the plane would just disintegrate on hitting and everybody in it would be killed, but that would be the only damage done.
Chernobyl, Three Mile Island.
Well, Three Mile Island was a joke. Not a soul was even slightly hurt. There was some expensive damage, to be sure, but the containment vessel, this concrete shield, held it all back. That's what they're there for.
Your independence of mind, of course, means that you, and I think your age gives you a great freedom in saying things. You're not at all concerned about making people cross, are you?
Oh, I am. I don't want to make you cross to start with.
You couldn't, James.
Incidentally, I briefly worked with Sir MacFarlane Burnett in the 1940s when I was working in virology at a strange hospital called Harvard Hospital in southern England.
Well, he was a dear man. Let's go back to your origins, because I find them fascinating. When did you have your epiphany that made you realise you wanted to be a scientist?
Oh, when I was about 4 years old, my beloved father, who I've already described, had the wisdom to give me for Christmas on my fourth Christmas, a box full of bits of wire and batteries and bells and other electrical little bits and ends. He said, there you are, play with that, that'll give you some fun. And it did. I thought it was by far the best present I'd had. But
I'd hate to think what would have happened if she'd given you dolls.
Or an atomic kit. But no, but I got puzzled because I couldn't see why you needed two wires to send electricity along, whereas you could send water or gas along just one pipe. And I kept asking people, and nobody could give me a satisfactory answer. And it dawned on me I'd have to find out for myself. And that's a fair way of starting as a scientist, I reckon.
But your family couldn't afford to give you a tertiary education. What happens next?
Well, that was great good fortune. You see, had I been the son of a rich family, I'd have gone to university like everybody else would have done in the circumstances. As it was, I got a job as a laboratory assistant with a firm of consultants in London. And that was the most wonderful apprenticeship for a scientist. They were a strange bunch. They would tackle any problem as long as it had to do with the photographic industry, all the way from gelatin manufacture right up to the synthesis of colour dyes that went into photographs. And for a youngster just leaving school to be thrown in at the deep end and given problems, there you are, solve it, was just wonderful. But they were also had terrific discipline. I was constantly told, when you do measurements and get results, they must be accurate. People's jobs depend on the right answers. Their lives even may depend on them. So never fudge anything. Now, this is the opposite of a student who is told by the professor or the invigilator, don't worry too much about getting the right answer, as long as you understand the method. And I think that is the wrong way of training scientists.
It got you into trouble, though, didn't it? When you were at Manchester, your accuracy of measurement, had you accused of cheating?
Yeah. Well, yes, I got lucky in a sense. Of course, World War II started, and they closed all the evening classes in London, but as an act of kindness, they gave the students at them the chance to go full-time as students as long as it was out of London. And I got a post in the second year at Manchester University. And the professor there he was a young man then, but eventually became Lord Todd, president of the Royal Society, so he was no slouch. But a month after I'd gone in, I was called to see him, and he said, Lovelock, why the hell have you been cheating? We've let you in under, easy conditions, and there you go and spoil your chances by cheating. I said, what do you mean, cheating? And he said, students do not get the right answer. He said, you must have looked up the answer in the book in the laboratory. And it took me at least 10 minutes to explain to him that the problem that I'd solved was something I could almost do in my sleep. And we both kind of felt, well, there's something a bit odd about teaching.
James, you were exempt from military service, of course, as a student, but you decided to register as a conscientious objector. Take us through your thought processes there.
Well, my mother was a Quaker, and I'd been brought up in that faith, more or less, right from a youngster. And if you were a Quaker, it was almost a matter of duty, an honour, to become a conscientious objector. So I didn't have much option, and I became one. But it wasn't long after the war was going that I realised it was a ridiculous stand and I couldn't maintain it. I mean, lives were being lost by merchant seamen bringing in the food I ate. I was being defended by brave young men in fighter aircraft. The whole thing was absurd, so I resigned. But you have to understand that if you've been brought up with a certain kind of thing you've got to do, it's the right and honourable thing, you tend to do it without thinking too hard.
Given your Quaker background and also the comparative poverty of your background, you were a socialist when young, mm-hmm. but you went through a political transformation during the Thatcher years. You became a a political and social conservative?
To an extent, yes, although I just certainly didn't support... I would not vote conservative, I disagree with an awful lot, but I had an immense admiration for Margaret Thatcher. She was a scientist, don't forget, one of the only prime ministers we've ever had that was a competent scientist. And this, of course, endeared her to me. She also was a great fan of Gaia. She tried to get her cabinet to read my first book. I don't think she succeeded. And a great supporter, too. So it was a kind of ambivalence thing. Mm. I violently disagreed with her views on the health service, for example, but I never got a chance to discuss it with her. All the conversation invariably was about the environment.
I've got bad news for you. You're in a country where our Prime Minister is not a scientist and is not a fan of Gaia and is pretty much a steadfast denier on climate change, but we won't get political. In 1957, your gift for being absolutely accurate in measurement blossoms in an invention called the Electron Capture Detector, the ECD. This has been an incredibly important tool, hasn't it, for all of us?
I guess so, yes. Some say it was the thing that did more than anything to start the Green Movement. It's not for me to make a judgment on that. I think that's for history. But it certainly, I've seen it associated with it. It certainly did a lot to first give support to Rachel Carson's great work. She, of course, if you remember rightly, wrote a book, Silent Spring, that stated that the unwise, widespread use of agricultural chemicals, particularly DDT and dieldrin and whatnot, were killing off birds. And the name of her book, Silent Spring, of course, envisaged a spring where there was no more birdsong because they were all dead from pesticide poisoning. She was right, of course. Nowadays, the spring is more or less silent in much of Europe. Perhaps in Australia too, I don't know, but certainly in Europe, but not just from pesticide poisoning. I'm afraid farmers regard all forms of wildlife other than their livestock, pets and family, in that order, as malign and to be destroyed. And they'll do it by any means. If you stop them using pesticides, they'll do it by any means they can.
As a lifelong admirer of Carson, I'm fascinated to observe there's a huge renewed attack on her and her work, the argument being that whilst DDT was bad for birds, it was rather good in preventing malaria.
Oh, that's so unfair. Rachel Carson was concentrated on birds, but as soon as city people read her book, they suddenly forgot the birds and thought of themselves. And then some idiot academics suggested that DDT was a carcinogen. I believe it is a slight carcinogen to rats or something like that, but I know of no case of human cancer coming from its use. But what they did was to ban it heedlessly because they were frightened of it. It's rather similar to the anti-nuclear story. Things get banned out of fear, out of superstition, not out of good sense. Actually, it is the most wonderful insecticide to use in places like Africa to destroy malarial mosquitoes. And it doesn't needn't be used at levels that affect the rest of wildlife and isn't. It's so bad that the ban on DT is responsible for something like 2 million deaths a year from malaria, to say nothing of 200 million whose lives are blighted by the disease. All of that was unnecessary. But don't blame Rachel Carson. It was the city, urban people of green persuasion that were responsible for that, not that great pioneer.
I think that a lot of the attack comes from the neocons who are in some strange way connected to the Bush war on science. But let's go back to your wonderful gadget, the ECD. Its first practical use was to detect pesticide residues in foodstuffs. Yeah. But you start using it in other ways yourself. Tell us the story about how the ECD played such a central role in the ozone layer crisis?
Oh, goodness. Well, of course, it's a strange device. For the most part, it only detects things which are very poisonous or carcinogenic, nothing else. And at the same time, it's probably the most sensitive simple chemical indicator you've got. It'll detect much less than a part per trillion. That's a part per million, so small that it's infinitesimal. And because of that, you can pick up traces of things like the chlorofluorocarbons in the air. Not that they are carcinogens or anything like that, but they do happen to react with it. And the story is a strange one. Where I lived in those days in the countryside west of London in Wiltshire, if any of you know it. And the skies used to be clear like they are in southern Australia, beautiful clear blue skies in the summertime. But gradually those skies got dimmer and dimmer and mistier until the haze was so thick you couldn't see sometimes much further than about 200 or 300 yards. Now, I thought it looked and smelt like the Los Angeles smog. But when I asked experts in Britain, the meteorologists, they said, oh, no, it must be something coming out of the ground. Couldn't possibly be Los Angeles smog here. We don't have bright enough sunshine, and there's not enough cars to produce it. But I felt convinced, nevertheless, that that's what it was. So I wondered, how can I prove it? It wouldn't be any use picking up smog compounds like ozone and sulfur dioxide and things like that in the air. But it suddenly dawned on me, wherever there's cities and people, there's CFCs being given off, but never are they given off by nature. They're not a natural compound at all. Sulfur dioxide and ozone are natural, so there's always confusion. So I started measuring the CFCs and soon found that they could go up to 5 times as much in the air when there was the haze as they were when it was clear air coming from the Atlantic. And that proved that the smog was indeed coming from industrial regions and was smog. And that was followed up, and now there's no doubt about it. Mm. It's part of the haze that, strangely enough, now keeps the Earth a lot cooler than it would otherwise be, because it reflects sunlight back to space.
The attack on the ozone hole gives one cause for a tiny piece of optimism in relation to climate change, because it was a case where there was an international effort to do something about it.
Indeed it was, and perhaps I should add that looking at the CFCs in the air as smog indicators made me wonder where the constant level in the clean air was coming from. Was it accumulating in the air of the world? Because they're so unreactive, there wasn't much anywhere for them to go. So I thought, what fun it would be to go on a ship to Antarctica and back and measure them all the way, which is what I did. And sure enough, they're present in the air all the way, right through around the world. And that paper that I wrote about it in Nature in 1972 was what kicked off the CFC ozone affair. I made my biggest blunder in that, because I said in the paper that these things represent no conceivable danger whatsoever. They're so non-toxic. But, of course, I hadn't realized then that they could, when they got into the upper atmosphere, that they split in under solar ultraviolet light and gave off chlorine that destroyed the ozone.
This is Late Night Live on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, ABC Online and via podcast. And this is a chat I had at this year's Adelaide Festival of Ideas with James Lovelock. He played to a packed house in the Bonython Hall at the University of South Australia. You're picked up by NASA. NASA asks you to start seeing if you can work out a way of analysing extraterrestrial atmospheres. You find a methodology of doing so. And in a strange way, this leads into Gaia.
Yes. That was a long time ago, Philip. I was invited to NASA in 1961, when they were only 3 years old.
Is that right?
Yes, and it was no great organisation. It was just a lot of caravans stuck on a hillside in California. And the people working there were not, strangely, hotshot scientists so much as model makers and clock makers and people like that, strange people. And they were exquisitely good at designing the wonderful instruments that went on spacecraft. And they needed me because I was a producer of sensitive instruments. And they wanted me to devise things for them that would measure the soil and atmospheres of Mars and the Moon. And that was my job. But I'm always a curious, nosy sort of scientist. And I got talking to the biologist there, and I was utterly astonished. They wanted to find life on Mars by just looking for the bacteria that grew in the soil there. And I said, well, how the hell do you know there are any bacteria there? It might be a form of life different from anything we've ever seen. And their attitude, after a while, got very cross and said, well, you clever bugger, you suggest something better. And that put me on the spot, and the only thing I could think of was to say, well, if you want to find life on a planet, look for a reduction of entropy, which doesn't help at all, doesn't help anybody. And I was called to see the boss of JPL the next day, and he said, what are you doing upsetting our biologists? NASA's hired them at great expense, and they're very miserable because you've been talking some nonsense about measuring entropy on Mars. So he said, what do you mean by it? How would you detect life that way? And I said, well, I need some time to think about it. He said, well, you've till Friday if you don't have an answer. That was Tuesday. On Thursday night, it suddenly dawned on me, yes, you can find an entropy reduction on a planet by just measuring the composition, that's the chemical composition of its atmosphere.
Obvious and simple.
Well, it actually isn't so complicated. If the planet's dead, the gases in the atmosphere will all have reacted with one another to the point where they can't react anymore. They'll be at what's called chemical equilibrium. But if there's life on the planet, it's got to use the atmosphere as a source of raw materials, just like life here does. Mm. And it's got to use it as a place to deposit its waste products, just as we do. And this will change the atmosphere and make it recognizably different from... And, of course, the control planet was the Earth. Does it fit? Yeah, sure, it absolutely sings out that it's a live planet. You've got oxygen mixed with methane. Now, that's the kind of mixture, if the composition's wrong, will blow up in a big bang. Fortunately, it's regulated. And it stays at levels which are quite safe. But it requires that they're reacting together, because they react in the stratosphere when sunlight falls on the Earth. And that means there must be a source and a sink for them. There must be something making them, and the sink is the reaction, of course. And you can easily calculate what that is, and it means huge quantities for the Earth. And there's no way that that could happen on a dead planet. NASA accepted that and got quite excited, and they still have it in mind to use it to find life on planets way out beyond the solar system.
We're not dealing with a eureka moment for Gaia, are we?
No,
we're dealing with a thought process.
On life detection, yeah. Mm. The eureka moment came when an astronomer came into the office I was in with a great sheet of data on the actual atmosphere of Mars and Venus. And these were so close to chemical equilibrium that I knew I was on the right tracks, because by then we're pretty sure that they were dead planets. And when you compared it with the Earth, it was then that this idea that life was regulating the atmosphere came to me. That was very much the eureka moment.
When I first read you on Gaia, and when we first talked about it quite a few years ago, I was concerned that its metaphoric majesty had become too Well, that the New Age had embraced it rather eagerly, to the point that I'm sure you must have been embarrassed by your disciples.
I was, yeah, who wouldn't? But on the other hand, let me go into it a bit. When I first put the idea forward, scientists quite liked it. I gave a lecture on it to the space scientists in 1968, and everybody was very happy with the idea, thought it was a good one. And then later, I gave it to climate scientists in 1971. They liked it too. And it wasn't until somewhere in the mid-70s, the biologists suddenly got the whole notion wrong. They thought it was an attack on Darwin. Mm. And of course, as you well know, biologists regard Darwin as next to the Holy Ghost. I mean, if anybody says anything bad about Darwin, then you're for it. So I was for it. But it was all a mistake, because I'm as much for Darwin as they are. And it's not contrary to Darwin, it's merely an extension of Darwin. And I think it's most unfair on Darwin that nobody sort of looks back on his history and sees that when he came up with the theory of evolution, the general paradigm was that the Earth was absolutely fixed. The environment didn't change, it repeated itself continuously. It's called uniformitarianism in geology. And that therefore organisms merely had to adapt to what was there, and that was it. Had that not been so, geologists had been a bit more broad-minded, Darwin, I'm sure, would have seen that organisms can change their environment as well as adapting to it. Damn it all, we're changing ours, and look what's happening. And this is part of evolution. It will change, and organisms that foul the environment go extinct.
As I came to understand what you were on about, I realised that it wasn't in any way a spiritual concept. It was a tough, robust, and in fact, quite a hard-hearted view. You know, Gaia was not particularly concerned with human beings, in fact, not concerned with them at all.
I'm not sure about that. Well, I was going to put this bit at the end as a kind of cheerful closure, but since you fed it to me now, I better go into it. Look, you see, life on our planet, the great system, well, that thing I call Gaia, it's been around for nearly 4 billion years. That's a third of the age of the universe, would you believe it? Mm. Now, it's taken that system, let's call her for a change, because Gaia was a Greek goddess, it's taken her that long to evolve a creature that can think, and not only think, but communicate amongst themselves. And for the very first time, she's been able to see herself from space and see what an incredible, beautiful planet she is compared with the dead sisters, Mars and Venus. And if you think that she's neutral about us, you may be very wrong.
You're listening to LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, via ABC Online and Podcast. And this conversation with the remarkable James Lovelock was recorded a few days ago at the Adelaide Festival of Ideas. Okay, I know that you have a friendly relationship with Dawkins.
Yeah.
And I don't think you would accept the label of atheist, would you?
No. I'm an agnostic.
What is your theology?
I'm an agnostic. I'm a scientist. I can't be certain about anything. And I think the atheist position, that's a pure atheist, is impossible because you're certain there is no God. How can I, as a scientist, say that? I think the existence of God is very improbable, but it's one hypothesis amongst many about the universe.
Well, Dawkins takes that view that it's highly improbable.
He does now, but he used to be a what I call a card-carrying atheist. That no way is this is there any religion.
To what extent is your Quaker background still an influence in your life?
Well, you see, the Quaker Church is very happy with agnosticism and science, because God, if there is a God, is the still small voice within. In other words, it's within your mind, it's part of your own concepts. Mm. It's your conscience that tells you what you should be doing something. It's not, none of Quakerism is really concerned with a theological God out there somewhere in the universe.
At the back you had a sheet of notes, and I want to get you to pull them out with this question as we approach the end of our conversation. What are your current, or indeed perhaps final, thoughts on the issue of Gaia and climate change?
Gaia and climate change. Well, my final thought was going to be the one about the planet being pleased with us for having shown how good she is. No, but my thoughts about Gaia and climate change are fairly important, I think. You see, most of us base our fears on climate change on the advice given by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which represents about 1,200, I believe it is, of the world's best scientists who strongly agree on the facts of climate change, and they published their report in February this year. And I strongly advise you, if you haven't seen it, to at least get hold of a digest of it and look at it. It's a fearsome report. And it shows all of the predictions. And if you look at what it predicts by 2040, which is not all that far ahead, 33 years, it suggests that by 2040 in Europe, the temperatures every summer will be as hot as the summer of 2003. That will be recognised by anyone in Australia, because the temperatures for June, July and August were all between 40 and 50. It stayed there, and it was total drought during that period. Now, if that happens, people may get used to it, because people do live in under those conditions, but the plants won't, so Europe will become very like Australia, scrub and desert. How are they going to feed 450 million on scrub and desert? And it won't just be Europe. The same thing will be happening to China, North America, parts of Africa and South America. So how is the world going to feed 6.5 billion? Well, there'll be more then. There'll probably be 7 to 8 billion on scrub and desert. And that's why it's a really worrying and serious report. The very latest observations of what the climate is doing from the best scientists also around the world, but observations are real, they're not modelled predictions, show that all three indicators, that's temperature, sea level and carbon dioxide, are at a worse state now than even the gloomiest of the IPCC predictions. So the planet seems to be on course to something a lot worse than the IPCC suggests. Now, this is where Gaia comes in with a ray of hope. And you see, the IPCC models are purely geophysical. They don't include the biology of the planet. They're non-Gaian models. All those geophysicists acknowledge Gaia, but they don't yet. They don't know how. It's not negligence or obstinacy. They don't know how to put it in their models. So they give a rather worse picture than would happen if you include the effects of life on the planet. When you do, what you find is that instead of rising indefinitely, the temperature levels off at somewhere about 5 degrees hotter than it is now. That's bad enough, and there'll still be the scrub and desert, but it's not just a runaway to nothing. And the Earth has been in that state many times before in its past history. There were no great extinctions when that happened. Life was able to move to the polar regions and carry on and wait until it cooled off again and then move back. That happened 55 million years ago. We've got good records of it. It's going to be a rough, an incredibly difficult world, and there won't be that many survivors. I'll be very surprised if as many as 20% of us now on the planet survive at 2100. But we will survive, and we will carry on. And let's hope that we'll have learned a big lesson from it.
But typically of you, James, you also have worked out a couple of rather large ideas which might help Gaia get us over the hurdle.
Well, that's visionary. But you see, when people talk about saving the planet, carbon trading, renewable energy, sustainable development, I think it's just blowing in the wind. I don't think any of that will make the slightest difference to climate change. For example, if you could stop all fossil fuel burning tomorrow, everywhere in the world, every ounce of coal, every cc of petrol was not to be burnt. It was a hanging matter if you burnt it. What do you suppose would happen? It wouldn't get cooler. It wouldn't stay the same. It would rapidly get hotter. And because of that haze I mentioned some time ago, that haze only lasts in the atmosphere about 2 months. Turn off all combustion and there's no source for it, so it falls out. And then the full force of the greenhouse heat comes on. It's not just that much hotter, because when it gets hotter, the Earth itself will start to pour forth carbon dioxide instead of taking it in as it's doing now. The reason? Because natural ecosystems will go to scrub and desert, and they'll no longer be doing their job of regulating climate. So things will get much worse. And any halfway point, like Kyoto, is no better. It just delays the end result. So what can we do? Well, the only thing there's two things we can do, and the Americans will be the first to do this, I think. One is a temporary cure by putting up sunshades in space, stopping sunshine. The other one, which is equally good and probably easier, is to get the airlines to put an aerosol of fine particles in the stratosphere as they go about their flights. That's not a bad idea. And that would...
This is to add to global dimming, in effect.
Global dimming, that's right. Pinatubo, a volcano, did it in 1991, and there was 3 years' relief from global warming. And so we know how much stuff to put up there to do it. Mm. And it's quite feasible for airlines to do it. So that's a possibility, and the one I think will follow. But it won't work as a long-term cure. It's a bit like going on dialysis when your kidneys fail. Nobody would refuse dialysis, because death's the alternative, but you don't expect it to be a long-term cure. So we need something more drastic if we're going to help the Earth to cure itself. Always regard as foolish pride the idea that we can save it. It's got to be the planet saving itself. And the only way we can do that is by taking its largest ecosystem, which is the ocean, it's 70% of the Earth's surface, and turning it from its current positive feedback on climate, that's to say the hotter it gets, a vicious circle, turning it back to its normal regulatory mode of opposing climate change and helping to cool the planet. How can we do it? Well, the reason it's in a bad state and unhealthy is that as the Earth warms, the top layer of water grows so warm that it's stable and floats above the cooler waters below. And the cooler waters below are full of nutrients, but that top layer, all the nutrients are used up by the algae in it so that it becomes a desert. And that's why the top layer of the sea is so clear and blue nowadays. You think it looks beautiful, but it isn't. It's just an ocean desert. Now, if we can get the water from below up into the top layer and mix in, then the algae will grow again and do their job of helping us cool the planet. It will be a monstrous operation. You'll need vast numbers of pipes, about 100 meters long and 10 meters in diameter, with a flat valve at the bottom. And what they would do would, as the waves go over, every time a wave goes over, cool water from below will be pumped up, mix in with the top layer, and hopefully that will do the job. But as I say, it's visionary, and I think of it and mention it, not so much because I feel confident it will work, I don't, but it will stimulate someone to think of a better idea, but based on this principle, help the Earth to save itself.
James, one of the other guests here at the Festival of Ideas, Rabbi John Levy, is being chased around the festival by a Holocaust denier who stands up and makes an impassioned statement every time the poor rabbi gets to the lectern. You have not been attacked by climate change deniers here, but as you know, there's still a lot of them, and some of them claim to be scientists. How do you deal with them? What do you say to them?
Well, I'm very cross with them. They represent the most tiny minority of scientists, just as the Holocaust deniers represent a tiny minority of ordinary folk around. And they're given enormous prominence, mainly, I think, by what you might call vested interests. It's very natural for large oil and coal companies not to want to hear too much about climate change, because it's bound to affect their profits and their industry, and they naturally react. And as I suspect that many of the strong climate deniers are not speaking purely for themselves. There's bound to be one or two genuine souls who really believe. I think Dr. Linson of MIT is one such, who believes there are alternate theories. But as a scientist, the evidence is so contrary that it's quite absurd to hang on to them. In science, it isn't a debate. It's not like human affairs. The final arbiter is always nature itself, and that always tells you who is right or wrong. It's not a matter of debate between people. So I don't think we have to take climate deniers very seriously.
James, you still work every day in your little laboratory, don't you?
Well, nowadays I spend most of the year coming to things like this.
But you wanted to come, James.
I know, because you were so persuasive, Philip. But no, I get far too little time to work. But we are going to write another book shortly and try and put down the things we've discussed today, how maybe to treat it.
Your curiosity is by no means diminished with the passing of time, is it?
Heavens, no. If you don't keep an interest and have something to look forward to, well, I mean, I think your body decides to turn off.
Mm. What projects are you working on at the moment, may I ask?
Well, these pipes that I mentioned.
That's one. Yes. But you're always juggling projects.
No, this
like
is a
Chinese
big enough one
juggler
to keep,
does plates.
That's a big enough one to keep anybody busy.
Mm. James, you have been showered in accolades and prizes and honours. You've had, the house must be impossible to move around with all the statuettes and he must dust them constantly. I believe Her Majesty gave you one recently.
Yes, that was a Companion of Honour award. Yes, that was very pleasant, because you get 10 minutes talking with her.
And do you now?
Yes.
Do you now?
And she's a remarkable lady. I can't, unfortunately, from protocol, tell you the nature of our conversation.
Oh, there's only a couple of us here, James.
But let me say, she was not in disagreement.
Really?
About a lot of things.
Yeah. How do you react to honours? Do you find them pleasant, embarrassing, surplus to requirements?
No, I think it's... I'm very much a monarchist. I think it's a very good idea, really, because the alternatives, having some politician in charge, is almost odious when you think of it.
I don't think that's fair, James.
Well, there are rare exceptions. There are rare
exceptions.
We could
be fortunate enough to have a President Bush. I can't say.
Well, no, I think a monarchy is an excellent idea, and the constitutional monarchy is, in most countries it still exists, has grown up as a very comfortable institution for the nation, and it always means that some bastard can't get to the top. The place is already taken, and this is wonderful. So I think any honours that they just spread around, well, why not?
The gong you've just got, is that equivalent to a knighthood?
No, it's above it, actually.
It's above the knighthood.
I'm glad they didn't give me a knighthood, because a knighthood's for a leader of men, some distinguished person who's built up an organisation or done something really good. Nowadays, they're often sports figures, but it's just the same. It's somebody who's leading a team or something, whereas Companion of Honour is for an oddball like me, somebody who's worked on their own and achieved things. And that's a nice distinction.
James, it's not enough to convert me to becoming a monarchist, but let us briefly examine the appalling performance of Bush on Science. We've done quite a lot
Well, he's not a monarch.
No, God but he's, he behaves like an absolute monarch, and he's certainly terribly opposed to most scientific activities. His line on, say, stem cell research has been abysmal. His denial of climate change, of course, notorious.
Oh, well, but he won't, fortunately, under the American Constitution, he won't be there very much longer. Will you have a chance of change?
Yes. So you're calm about that?
I'm calm. Yeah.
Have you talked to Gore? Have you had social intercourse with Big Al?
Sorry, which one?
Al Gore.
Strangely, no, I haven't. It's just by accident. What's his name? Sir Richard Branson had this wonderful idea of offering a prize of $25 million to anybody who can come up with a really realistic solution to climate change. He was very wise because he cut me out of it with my pipe by making me a judge on the panel. Now, a fellow judge is Al Gore, so and another one is your Tim Flannery, who I think has done so much to alert the world to the dangers coming up.
You'll be seeing Tim when you go to Sydney.
That's right, yes. So that's why I haven't yet seen Al Gore, but I'm bound to.
Mm. I hope that he'll be a late entrant in the presidential race. There's still a very strong suspicion.
Well, I think there's no doubt that he will have the right attitude on climate change.
Yes.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, an extraordinary fellow, James Lovelock. That brings us to the end of our week of programs from the Festival of Ideas in Adelaide. We'll be bringing you more from the festival over coming weeks. And I'd like to thank the team, Chris Short, Sharona Coots, Lila Schooner, Paul Goff, exec producer Chris Bullock. You can hear Classic LNL as usual after the 10 p.m. news on Friday night, and if you're up very early, after the 4 a.m. news on Sunday morning. Coming up now on ABC Radio National is the news. We'll see you later.
ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.